is a world free of poverty. And what we try to do is to see how we can diversify the approach of that engagement to seeing that our work with the private sector, our work with citizens, and then, of course, our work with governments enable the process of growth.
That's Obi Ezekwesili on Hard Talk after the news.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Opposition groups in Syria say the security forces have opened fire on anti-government demonstrations across the country, including the capital, 10 of them in the northern town of Marat al-Numan. And a court building was set on fire. Syrian state television said government forces had been attacked by what it called well-armed terrorist groups. As the number of Syrian refugees arriving in Turkey increases, a huge new camp is being built by the Red Crescent. It's estimated that about 3,000 people, most of them women and children, have sought refuge so far. Owen Bennett-Jones is at the border town of Karbayas.
There are lots of minibuses parked in the centre of...
You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR Vancouver. It's whatever. Hip hop, R&B, jazz. It's whatever. Reggae, soul, mainstream. It's whatever. News, sports, and entertainment.
And yes, we're here on Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and in other cities. And of course, you can find this show online anytime. If you go to Google, type in Oz Stranded, that's OzStranded. And the first page that comes up will be the blog, and you'll be able to see all the songs I'm playing today and any other day. And I have also the podcast link and a video, one of the videos that I play in the show. So I'm really glad you're tuning in today, because it's an extra special show. I'm going to devote most of the show to one single band, because I found a really interesting documentary on YouTube, a multi-part documentary on the metal band Alchemist. Alchemist is a band from the Australian Capital Territory, Canberra, which is the capital city. So the ACT, Australian Capital Territory, is like the District of Columbia in the United States. So it's its own little island in the middle of New South Wales. And it's, well, people say it's somewhat of a boring place, but one of the most interesting things, I think, to come out of the city has been Alchemist, who are widely regarded as the best Australian metal band, progressive metal band. I guess if you wanted to narrow down their sound, they're a prog metal band, and they've been around for a long, long time. They formed in 1987, and so far have released 6 studio albums and an EP and a compilation. And work began on an EP in 2010, but the band apparently is on an indefinite hiatus for the time being. They're a very consistent band, and they're the only group to have appeared at every single Metal for the Brain festival. That was a long-running festival that happened in Canberra. It was a meeting of all the great metal bands in the country would converge for one weekend a year at the Metal for the Brain festival that raised money for medical research. They're an interesting band whose styles combine death metal, progressive rock, psychedelic, Eastern, Aboriginal and electronic influences. A very interesting, eclectic mix of sounds. Very high quality music. And I'm going to be playing for you the whole documentary that I found on YouTube, all about the band. And to start with, for some context, I thought I would play for you track one to their Spiritech album, which is a classic in my life. I really got into this album when I first got into the band, and the first song is called Chinese Whispers, and it's a stunning song. So here's to get you into the mood for the Alchemist documentary.
Bye. Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
And we are back here on CITR, and this is the Stranded Australian Canadian Music Show, and the special show here featuring the band Alchemist, the amazing progressive metal band from Canberra. And I just played for you the full 9 minutes there of Chinese Whispers, which is the first track on the Spiritech album by Alchemist, just to whet your appetite for learning about the band. And here we go. This is part one of Alchemist Embryonics, Unreleased History of Alchemist.
Alchemist is one of Australia's most innovative, exciting and enduring metal acts who have been at the forefront of the Australian music scene for over 15 years. Throughout their extensive career, the band has consistently delivered unique, aggressive music with thought-provoking lyrics and critically acclaimed live performances. Alchemist have withstood the test of time in a diminutive music scene devoid of any real commercial success. Alchemist have an enduring and colourful history. This is their story. In 1987, Alchemist already had a strong reputation as an exciting new metal band in their hometown of Canberra, Australia. The group was formed by a then 16-year-old, Adam Agius, whose reputation as a fast and impressive thrash metal guitarist preceded him. In 1989, drummer Rodney Holder was enthusiastic when asked to join the band. Rodney and Adam had met via the local scene, and the two strong personalities immediately gelled. Adam and Rodney, along with guitarist Andrew Meredith and bassist James Priest, worked hard at establishing the embryonic rumblings of what would become the modern Alchemist sound. In 1990, the band released their first demo, simply titled Alchemist Demo 90. Despite its horrendous production values, this recording sold well for the young band and pinpricked the international metal underground via aggressive tape trading.
It's hilarious to listen to now, but I think the songs were really, really strong thrash metal. Dude, we had no idea what we were doing in the studio. I went for a blowfly guitar sound and I went for a cowbell kick drum sound. I listen back to them now and I'm pretty proud of those songs. Just the production values are really bad.
I remember Roy telling me that he actually thought that that's how Alchemist actually sounded back then live. So it was a good representation of how we actually sounded with the gear we had back then.
Perhaps the most significant element to this early demo was the song Jar of Kingdom, a composition that showcased a technical thrash metal work embedded with slabs of raw psychedelia. This track excited the young band and gave them a direction to work towards, a path they believed could enable them to stand out amongst their peers in their chosen genre.
Jar of Kingdom, the song, is the first song that we ever did that was really had a massive psychedelic part in it.
Jar of Kingdom, the song really was the first sort of stepping stone in that direction.
Jara Kingdom, the song, represented where we wanted to be and how we thought we were different from the rest of the scene.
But before the group could further progress, a lineup change was required as the band needed to find a new bass player. In 1991, John Bray was plundered from Exceed, another popular local Canberra band.
Well, me and Adam said, well, let's see if this guy, we can get him into Alchemist.
Adam and Rod came and approached me and just said, look, you know, I don't know what you're doing with Exceed, because they didn't know that I was having hassles with Exceed. And they just came and said, do you want to join Alchemist? And I just went, fuck yeah.
He seems like a good enough bloke, and he's a pretty good bass player, and he's got good gear, so let's get him in the band.
That weekend, we all got together and started jamming together and just went, yeah, this is cool. This is way better. We really basically tried to remake Alchemist and try and start again.
John's arrival at Alchemist brought a focus to the songwriting that was unprecedented, and soon there was enough material for a new recording. Alchemist's Demo 91 delivered a significant progression in the songwriting and more polished production values. The recording showcased the group's original ideas and further propelled their popularity in the evolving Australian metal scene. Alchemist now began performing their first interstate shows with illustrious acts such as Sadistic Execution, Addictive and Mortal Sin. More importantly, the band was now receiving numerous positive reviews from around the globe. The future was looking exciting for the band, and it came as a surprise to the group when longtime guitarist Andrew Meredith suddenly resigned. The search for a new guitarist was brief, and soon Roy Talkington was chosen as a replacement. Roy was a young and talented guitarist who shared a similar music vision and life attitude as Alchemist.
I went to do college, year 11. At the same time, Rod went back to college to do year 13, and we sort of met there because we did a lot of classes. All I pretty much did was music at college, and I was in a few of those classes, and we got on real well. And their other guitarist left, and then he asked me, which was a bit of a surprise, and because I was a fair bit younger than the rest of them, and back then it was more obvious.
Rod basically just hit him up and said, mate, do you want to come and join Alchemist?
I think it must have been pretty nerve-wracking for Roy when we first tried him out.
When my first rehearsal, we sort of turned up at Adam's house with the rest of them. I sort of knew the other two. I hadn't met Adam very much. And, you know, they were all big personalities.
Basically, we just played one song which he had learnt, and it was a bit rough around the edges, but we just knew that he was the right guy.
We jammed out a few songs, went to the shops, went back in the van, had some billies.
Spent about 15 minutes on the music, just said, yeah, mate, you're in, and then went to force marijuana down his throat.
Yeah, that was pretty much more important than how the playing was just fitting with the guys and their lifestyle, I guess.
Later on, Roy tells a story that he was greening out. But he just had to hold everything back because, you know, he was trying to impress his new band members.
It really felt like the completion of the unit, you know, we really sort of immediately gelled.
He was, basically the final piece in the puzzle.
Thank you.
Roy's inclusion to the band would solidify a stable lineup and creative partnership that remains strong almost 15 years later. In early 1992, Alchemist were offered their first recording contract by Austrian independent label Lethal Records.
One day I get a phone call from Rodney, who'd gone to the PA box and found that a small independent label called Lethal Records from Austria wanted to sign the band.
After me. Bugger off. Bugger off. Sod. Sod. Bloody. Bloody. Now put them all together. Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Bugger off, you bloody sod.
Okay, you're in. Let's smash things up. We'll be right back.
Listen to Generation Annihilation on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC Radio in Vancouver.
And we are on CITR listening to the documentary on Alchemist, the great Australian metal band. I played for you the first part of Alchemist Embryonics, Unreleased History of Alchemist. And I played for you there a track from their way at the start of their career, from the Jar of Kingdom album, and that's called Wandering and Wandering. You can already hear that really inventive sound that they started there, infusing some Middle Eastern influence and some acoustic guitar into their death metal. So let's go on to part two of the documentary. This is a documentary on Australian band Alchemist.
We did get a few good reviews overseas in European magazines and what have you. And that's where Lethal Records first heard of us. I couldn't believe my eyes. There's a record contract in the mail.
We finally got a record fucking deal. Not that it was anything to jump up and down about.
Oh, it was all pretty exciting at the time, you know, record contracts. And I guess that was before a lot of people, you know, really did records.
So we basically jumped at the opportunity, like, cool, we can do a full length at last.
Yeah, it was cool. I guess I felt I was just at the right place at the right time.
Listen to a lot of Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and stuff, as well as the heavier bands like Autopsy and Pungent Stench. So it's just we put it all into a big boiling pot and came out with Alchemist.
And say, hey, you sound like you're vomiting when you sing. This is true.
We got said in the newspaper the other day that we write our songs about Dungeons and Dragons, but we don't.
New Look Alchemist spent the remainder of that year performing shows and writing material for their first full-length CD.
The writing of Jar of Kingdom was kind of on a bit of a probationary period for me, so I sort of just went with the flow.
We wanted to write Piper at the Gates of Dawn for death metal, basically, and we had all these very ambitious ideas. And
we were really wanting to break some ground and be completely different from the extreme scene that there was at the time, which was death metal and grindcore. Recording of Jar of Kingdom was an absolute nightmare for me.
Went to the studio and it was really full on conditions.
We were really on a limited budget, and we ended up having to record at night times because they have like a lockout period in the studios.
We could only afford to record from 10 at night till 6 in the morning.
It was the middle of the Australian summer, you know, like sort of 35 degrees.
Recording all through the night and trying to sleep in the day.
Sleeping in cars, not getting much sleep, being very tired, getting very pissed off at each other because of lack of sleep.
We're also saving money on accommodation, so we're staying on someone's floor, and it was actually a flea-ridden house.
And it was hot and we were staying with, you know, crusty hippies on the beach.
There'd be fleas all over you, flicking them off, you know. It was just absolutely gross.
Yeah, it was cool fun, but pretty full on.
It fucking killed us.
Unfortunately, we didn't get the engineer that we wanted. He was unavailable to record it, so we were with a new guy we'd never worked with before, and didn't really work out with him. He had a different vision for us, like, you know, he's putting on Nirvana CDs going, you know, check out this guitar sound, and we're going, you know, fuck no, we want to sound like Entombed, you know.
Adam's vocals deteriorated pretty quickly.
I can remember him, you know, screaming so hard recording Abstraction, the first song on the record, and thinking, yeah, that's sounding good.
Well, I got through Abstraction, which is the first song on the track, with vocals that are passable.
But him coming out after recording it, his voice was gone.
Pretty much because I was so tired, I lost my voice completely. And it just never came back. It just never came back. So we had a couple of days where we were just recording instruments and not trying to do any vocals.
Yeah, we were all looking at each other going, what the fuck are we going to do?
I remember being at Rich Studios and just trying the vocals so hard and, you know, looking through the glass at the boys and going, how's that? You know, and they're all sort of going, yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I could tell that they just thought it sounded terrible, but, you know, what could they do and what could I do? We had no more money left, we had no recording time left. We sped the tape up so anything I sung when you played it back at normal speed would sound lower to try and get that death metal sound. And the end result is the turdy, guttural vocals on Jarrah Kingdom, which I must say, some of our fans just absolutely love. They love the desperation in it, and they're not wrong. It was completely desperate, and there's a like band in joke, you know, when we talk about the vocals on that. So like, I'm trying! I'm really trying! And that's what it was like for me. It was terrible. I hated it. But at the end of the day, I was so happy to have put out our first record.
We had grand plans. It really didn't turn out how we wanted.
I guess we had delusions of grandeur a bit at the time, but we sort of always knew what we were kind of going to expect, but we got to put out a record, that was all we really cared about.
It amazes me to this day how many people say, oh yeah, I like your stuff, but you know, Jarrah Kingdom, that was where you peaked kind of thing. It's interesting to hear that because, you know, Jarrah Kingdom turned out nothing like we had hoped. We really wanted sort of this polished death metal sounding, like I said, Piper at the Gates of Dawn type of album. But it didn't happen, obviously.
The title Jarrah Kingdom was Rodney's brainchild. I remember him ringing me up one morning pretty excited.
I remember watching a guy called Graham Kennedy, who was a legend of Australian television, and he was talking about gorilla in vitro fertilisation, and it was like a sort of a comedy piece, and he was talking about how there was the semen in the test tube. When it went back to Graham Kennedy, he said, did he have in his hand what I thought he had, like a jar of kingdom?
Blowing a load in a in a test tube, and there you got a jar of kingdom.
In 1993, Jar of Kingdom was released to critical acclaim. Although the band was disappointed with the poor sound production, the ambitious song ideas were captured on tape, and the recording immediately brought the group significant notoriety, both in Australia and internationally. Critics were baffled how to categorise this release, with its over-the-top death metal approach, pulled with multi-layered psychedelia, sound effects, and esoteric lyrics.
Jarrah Kingdom is the most psychedelic, spasticated, extreme metal album ever.
I listen to it now and just, I cringe a lot, because I know, you know, deep down what we really wanted to achieve, and, you know, we maybe got halfway there.
It's a crazy album. It's very hard for me to listen to. I think we've refined our style a little bit more since then, but I still really respect that record. The Jarrah Kingdom album covers it. Well, it's a fluke. It actually turned out as good as it did.
I remember getting Lethal Records' first album cover and looking at it and just going, oh, that is shit. It just looks so crap.
And we opened it up, and it literally was a picture of a table in a room with a superimposed skull floating upon it.
We were just like, no, that is just crap.
And we just all went, you got to be kidding. You know, this has just got nothing to do with Alchemist and what we're about.
It was a lucky dip, because we said no to the first album cover they sent us, and he said, oh, well, this is what you're getting the second time. So when we got the layout for Jarrah Kingdom, it wasn't too bad.
I actually really, really liked the original Jarrah Kingdom cover. We were just really lucky that it actually suited the songs on it.
Yeah, people certainly didn't know what to make of the record, because, you know, it was so brutally heavy, or trying to be brutally heavy, and all over the place.
The production wasn't good. The song ideas weren't that fantastic, but the idea behind the record and the idea that Alchemist wanted to be a unique metal identity was what has brought us through.
Local media and recording companies suddenly developed a newfound curiosity for this independent band that had been signed by a European label. During this era, Alchemist's core following grew rapidly as the band also secured significant support slots for international heavies such as Creator, Pungent Stench and Bolt Thrower. In 1994, after heavy touring and writing schedules, the band returned to 2XX Studios in Canberra to demo new tracks for their forthcoming recording. The resulting Alchemist Primo 94 was sent to labels across the globe and heavily traded throughout the metal underground. Off the back of Jar of Kingdom's success, the band were presented with several recording contracts, and they soon signed with rising Australian indie label Shock Records for a three-disc deal.
Apex of Saturn!
Q's and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we are on Stranded, the Australian Canadian music show here on CITR 101.9 FM. And this is the special show on Alchemist, the progressive death metal band from Canberra. And I've been playing you a really fascinating documentary all about the band. They have been around since 1987. They're on an indefinite hiatus at the moment, but they've put out a huge amount of quality music, played Australia many, many times and toured Europe, and they have very dedicated fans the world around. So, you just heard there the wonderful tune Garden of Eroticism from the Lunosphere album, which was their second album. You've been hearing about the early part of their career. Now you'll be hearing a bit more about these, that second and then third albums. So this is Alchemist, Embryonics, an unreleased history of Alchemist. This is part three of the documentary.
Suppose after we'd done Jar of Kingdom, we decided, right, well, you know, we've got to back this up with a better record because we know we can do better.
We had toned down on the technical part and just basically focused more on being a psychedelic metal band.
Recording Lunosphere was really good times. The band was very tight and we were very, very focused.
I guess the Lunosphere record is when I got to contribute more and, you know, just was, trial was over, I was in the band, it was all proved, it was... I guess when I started having more creative input into the sound. It's kind of a more focused, matured direction from the craziness of Jar of Kingdom, I guess.
Oh man,
what have you been doing all day, Tao?
Playing pool.
Do you want to go?
Hey?
Do you want to go to pool?
Oh, game? I thought you said you
want
to go.
Yeah. No, Gut wanted to go.
I was really happy with the way I was actually able to perform the vocals that time.
Yeah!
I got the guttural death metal growls that I wanted to.
We do not die! We only change!
I think it still suffers a little bit production-wise just from just the overall sound of it, but it was a long time ago and sounds weren't quite as easy to get back then. But I think a lot of the ideas still stand up really strong. You know, the lyrics and the concepts on the album are all really strong.
It's amazing how many people, you know, interpret and read between the lines of Lunosphere stuff that we'd never imagined and come back to us and saying, oh, does this mean this and this mean this? It was basically just trying to write some interesting lyrics about topics we thought were unique and interesting. It would have been silly for us to sing about, you know, blood, death and hatred, because that's not the type of guys we were, you know. We were into good times and having fun and getting wasted.
The title Lunasphere, I think was Rod's.
I wanted to call it Lunasphere of Influence. I thought that was a really cool sort of title, and I think it was Roy and Adam sort of said, no, that doesn't sort of sound so good, that sphere of influence. What about we just call it Lunasphere?
It gave us a lot of scope for a good cover, you know, which was the first time that we utilised Roy's artwork.
Again, we sort of had the title to build the record around, and I remember, you know, sort of Roy coming up with the artwork based around the moon.
Yeah, I'd been doing a lot of the whole time, you know, way before computers, just pens and paints and stuff like that. And the Lunasphere cover was one of the series of pictures that I did around that era, just gouache on paper. And, it became a cover.
You know, we had a bigger budget now. We were on what at the time we thought was a great label, and we had the engineer that we wanted. And it was just a good, fun time.
Day three, I've just finished my drums and I'm fucking happy. Ads is in there doing the keyboards right now, so let's go take a look.
Can you see the counter from there?
Nah, I can't see shit. I've got fucked off, mate.
Can you bring your glasses? No, that's all right. No, I don't have any.
I remember us staying at the Glenside Hotel.
One of them necrophiliacs. Necrophiliac, you stupid asshole. I bet he's got ghillie scraps on under his stride.
I remember smoked a lot of cones.
I smoked 2 lakes of curves, second out. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I got this one for, you know, best single 94, the rest, you know, just tells the story of our schmutz.
I remember there was this mannequin in the studio at Powerhouse.
Ah. Oh, fucking hell. Hey, Roy.
Woo!
She's out from like amp pitch. Hey, you man, you look like you're playing someone else's Spinal Tap, man. She's got really crazy nipple, doesn't she?
It became the focal point and the mascot for the recording where you kick the shit out of it. All through the recording, it just got graffitied and tattooed.
We were graffitiing some mannequin that was around.
Hi, Roddy.
Good morning, John. Day two, Powerhouse. How you feeling, mate? How you think it's going?
Feeling good. Just having your Maccas.
Just do a quick interview, mate?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to the bog. Haven't heard anything yet. You know, fresh ears, ready to go.
Ed's just going to the bog.
Nah, you're not following me to the bog. You can hold the fucking hold on until you put that camera on. Fuck off, Rod.
No way.
I missed it. Did you guess?
I changed one of the lyrics to Yoni Kunda, but it fits in like springs from the moor. No, I'm going to say, observe sacred form with reverence, thoughts enthroned with the deep lust for life. And then the second time around, I'm going to say, serve her sacred form with reverence. Because that's the way it comes out anyhow.
Cool.
It makes sense anyhow. Observe. Served with reverence.
Observe! Sacred form! With reverence! Thoughts enthroned with a deep lust for life! Serve! Sacred form! With reverence! Thoughts enthroned with a deep lust for life!
1995, Alchemist's second album, Lunosphere, was released. This record saw a more concise songwriting approach, strengthened by enhanced production.
I think Lunosphere's got some really strong songs on it, songs that we continue to play to this day.
To me, they've stood the test of time, and even though we've played them to bloody death, I still enjoy playing them just as much as I did when we first wrote them.
It was a cool record, still some songs on that which stand up really well even today. And it was just a really good era for the band. Everyone was fully keen and focused, and we were just going hard. It was good fun.
They reflect perfectly the band at the time.
There's some songs on Lunosphere that we still play today, namely Yoni Kunda and Garden of Eroticism. And they're just really good, solid songs that I think still stand up today. We'll be right back.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver. Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts on Commercial Drive at Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore. You'll also save online at Band March Canada and Big Mama. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we are back on CITR 101.9 FM in Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show. Don't forget, you can go to the blog and find a full set list, podcasts and video. Go to Google and type in Oz Stranded, that's OzStranded, for the show blog. And this is a special show all about Alchemist, the amazing metal band from Canberra, the Australian Capital Territory. I'm playing you a five-part documentary that I've discovered on YouTube, and I hope you're enjoying learning about this very unique band. You just heard their Yoni Kunda, one of the classic songs off the record Lunasphere, the second album, which you heard all about the recording of in the last part of the documentary. I was fortunate enough to see Alchemist play a few times, and seeing that song live was just an extraordinary experience. So we have two more parts to get through. So straight into part four, this is Alchemist Embryonics, the unreleased history of Alchemist.
Lunasphere did quite well for us again. We were very lucky to receive really good reviews with Lunasphere and be able to tour off that record for a really long time.
That's one of my favourite albums, is Lunasphere, still to this day.
Basically, I think that Lunasphere is our first strong album, the first one we did that is strong.
There were a number of international labels enthusiastic to license Lunasphere, and Shock were unwilling to negotiate a deal. This created enormous frustration for the band, as it limited their new release to local distribution only. 1996 was an incredibly active year for Alchemist, as the band continued its hectic touring schedule across Australia. This period, the band continued to write material for a new CD, and at the end of the year, they entered Rocking Horse Studios in the serene settings of the Byron Bay rainforests.
Recording Spiritech was good. It was, again, we had a nice budget. We had the backing of the record company. We were in Byron Bay.
Part of the recording deal was we got this house in the rainforest, and that was awesome fun.
I can remember it just being a really good experience.
And we had, you know, several sort of cool parties and full wipeout days towards the end of the session.
Surfing, fishing, relaxation, rainforest. And it was a very relaxed environment to record Spiritech.
After a small break, the band travelled to Sydney to mix the recordings at Charing Cross Studios. By the end of the mixing sessions, the band realised that something had gone terribly wrong.
We enjoyed the whole thing, except for when we actually went to mix it.
The mixing experience of recording Spiritech, however, was quite stressful. We were in Sydney. It was, I guess, a lot more high pressure to get the songs mixed. And it just wasn't happening.
We got down there and it was just ancient gear.
We ended up spending the rest of our budget at Charing Cross mixing it, and walked away looking at each other saying, this is a pile of shit.
We tried for 5 days to mix something and just got nothing. We knew the sounds on tape were good. And it was just bloody heartbreaking, you know. We rang the label, we'd run out of all the money, we'd spend all their money in Charing Cross trying to mix it, and they said, no. You're not getting anything. Where's our record?
We basically, when we listened to it, it was worse than any demos that we'd done, and it had cost us a lot of money to get to that point, and it was not even worth releasing.
Alchemist were adamant that the recording could not be released in its current state, and that more funds were required to remix and complete the album. Disappointed, the group knew that the disc would not be released that year, and they began searching for an alternative source of funds to complete their recording. In early 1997, after a generous loan from Adam's parents, Alchemist decided on utilising unknown engineer and producer D.W. Norton to remix the record. D.W. had produced the early Super Heist demos, and Alchemist took a chance, entrusting the young engineer to rescue their recording.
Richie basically rescued that recording for us. We went back down to Melbourne. We were in so much debt, but we all decided the debt was worthwhile.
He put his hand up after talking to him and said, look, I'll have a go at mixing that album for you. And to be honest, we didn't really have much of a choice. We were at a point where we needed to have it mixed, and it needed to go into production, and we needed it out. And Richard Norton was our last line of hope to get this album out, and he ended up saving it and doing a really good job, and we were really happy with it at the end of it.
When Spiritech was finally released, it proved to be a landmark album for the band.
Spiritech's always very special to me because it's where we started to hit our stride and where we started to actually write really strong songs.
A lot of metalheads really got into that record, and again, touring off the back of Spiritech took our reputation, took our following to another level.
The time when we were sort of pretty much at the top of our game.
We wrote some cracking songs for Spiritech, ones that I'm very proud of, and again ones that we still play live. Many people still say to me, you know, Chinese Whispers is the best song you guys have ever written.
You know, it's a special album for me. I listened to Chinese Whispers and the intensity of the screams on that in the chorus, and it shocks me. They're a very, very mental thing, you know. It's not so much a physical thing. They're a really hard thing to do if I don't feel it, and it's hard to explain, but it's all about feeling it.
We knew we needed a music video.
We had Road to Ubar, and we all thought, okay, that's going to be our film clip song.
Yeah, we had these grand ideas, and we spent heaps of money on a professional company coming out, filming it on Betacam.
Really? They had no fucking idea.
We got all our mates together from the Canberra metal scene and, you know, got a bonfire out the bush and had them dancing around it.
We went out to a friend's house and had a huge bonfire and got our friends to run around.
You know, some of our mates were still in suits from their day job, and you know, we'll smear charcoal on all our faces and jump around the fire, and it's just really funny. And there's a really cool drum loop in the song. I remember having the idea of, right, yeah, like, get this bongo drum, man, you know, and mime it. You know, the bongo drum's this big, you know, and it's obvious that the sample is done on, like, kettle drums and a big, massive percussion. when it goes that part of the song, here's Rod, like, playing bongos.
It was just absolute garbage. I remember when we first looked at it, we put it on, and we all looked at each other, and we all knew what each other was thinking, and it was just like, oh my god, how much money did we just spend on that?
When we first saw the roughs of Road to Ubar, we all looked at each other and thought, oh geez, that looks bad.
We still released it because we just had to justify, well, we didn't spend that much money to not release it.
It was funny and not quite what we had in mind, but not many people were doing videos back then either, so it was a learning experience worth doing.
you know, you live and learn, and we learn a lot from that one.
And to this day, Road to Ubar still gets played on Australian television some nights late, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's very embarrassing.
It's the funniest clip ever. I mean, you know, our friends get a great kick out of it. Then again, you know, a lot of people always mention that clip, oh, I saw a Road to Ubar clip, and I think that's just the strength of the song coming through, you know. It still gets played every now and then, and it's going to be on our... on this DVD at the end, so, you know, you get to see what everything I'm laughing about, and, but, you know, you will also really appreciate the song if you're an Alchemist fan. Here's the funniest clip ever made by an Australian band, Row to Uber.
you doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And this is Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show. Thanks so much for listening to this special on Alchemist, the death metal, progressive psychedelic metal band from Canberra, one of my all-time favourites, and renowned around the world for very punishing and visionary metal. There's very few bands I've heard sound quite like Alchemist. You just heard their classic single there, Road to Yuba, from the Spiritech album from 1996. And there's one more part of the documentary to go, which we'll get into right now, and then hopefully time for one or two more tracks from the band as well. So this is part 5 of Alchemist, Embryonics, Unreleased History of Alchemist.
Used both here and abroad. Alchemist again toured heavily on this recording, supporting international acts like Strapping Young Lad and Cradle of Filth. 1998 continued Alchemist's intensive touring schedule across Australia, and they performed numerous high-profile shows, including supports for Pitch Shifter and Brutal Truth. Later that year, Alchemist returned to Backbeat Studios in Victoria and recorded a tribute to Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds soundtrack.
The album, for me personally, used to scare the shit out of me when I put it on as a kid.
Someone brought it to the band's attention that it was the 100th anniversary of the book, or something to do with the War of the Worlds.
We decided to do Eve of the War, which is pretty much, you know, the anthem track on that record.
We also needed to have something out at the time while we were writing a new record, which is going to take a while. So
we decided that, yeah, let's just do the song Eve of the War, and let's do it our way and make it, you know, something really special.
And I remember jamming it and going, fuck, this sounds really good.
We started jamming it and it instantly sounded good, you know. We really, really liked it. We thought, well, this is a great idea for an EP, you know. We'll get down there and we'll record this Eve of the War, put the live tracks on it and the dodgy remix.
I'm not too thrilled with the rest of the content on that EP, but, yeah, it was good. Yeah, the Eve of the War artwork was right when I was crossing to digital and actually doing the design and layouts ready for the printer for the releases. And it was ambitious, and we went right to full deadline, working overnight to finish it off, but it was cool.
With Pod People's Josh Nixon on guitar and DW Norton at the controls, the Eve of the War EP was quickly recorded. This mini CD did surprisingly well for Alchemist, as it charted nationally and received frequent national airplay.
When we released it, it did incredibly well for us, more than we could have ever imagined, you know.
And it ended up being probably our biggest selling disc out of the lot.
The song Eve of the War became an instant Alchemist fan classic. It lifted the band's profile somewhat. We toured quite successfully on it.
Again, it's a great song to play live. Fun song to play. A real vibe off the stage between us as a band, and also the crowd love it. You know, we always get requested to play Eve of the War.
But it was a fantastic release to put out before the next record. We still play it today.
But at the time, we said, okay, well, let's do another music video. Let's do a music video for Eve of the War. We were so disappointed with the Road to Uba music video. We thought, well, fuck it, let's do it ourselves. Let's have a crack at just doing it ourselves. We shot that music video for about $50, put it together. And, again, it's funny and it's B-grade.
This is the second clip we did. Pretty cool clip. We just got together out of our rehearsal space, blacked it out, fucking headbanged like crazy, man.
Not too many people have seen this clip, so, you know, I hope you enjoy it. It was the first clip I did, and it was a lot of fun.
Check out Rod's hair. He's got hair.
We'll be right back.
Hanging on the wall, it looks so bad.